They called me Star back then, the name he gave me, the name I carved into my skin when I thought I was reborn. I watched from the edge of a blood-soaked living room while my sisters carved death into a pregnant woman's body, and I smiled. Not because I hated her, but because I thought we were saving the world. This isn't a redemption story. I don't get to be clean. I'm not asking for forgiveness. I just want to tell you the truth about how one man's voice became God, and how I let it damn us all. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation audiobook. If you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss a story. Today, we're honored to bring you The Infamous Family of Crime. Get ready to immerse yourself in a powerful mind-blowing manipulation thriller that will leave you on the edge of your seat. Because here, our mission is to keep you coming back for more. So without further ado, let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1. He looked straight through me. They say you never forget the moment your life splits in two, when who you were becomes a ghost and who you become starts whispering lies in your own voice. For me, it was the summer of 69. I was 17 and already too old for the world. The kind of girl you don't notice until she disappears. I had a suitcase full of record sleeves, a denim jacket that stank like bus fumes and motel mildew, and a hole in my chest where a mother's love should have been. Los Angeles wasn't what I expected. There was no golden promise, no movie magic. Just too many people with nowhere to go, sleeping in doorways or staring into the neon like they were waiting for a sign that never came. And then I met him. He didn't give me a name right away. Just looked at me like he already knew mine. Like he knew everything I'd ever done. I was sitting outside a gas station off Sunset Boulevard, pretending to read a discarded newspaper, trying to ignore the growl in my stomach. He strolled right up to me barefoot, long dark hair tangled at his shoulders, eyes the color of black coffee with something floating in it. Madness or magic, I didn't know. I didn't care. He sat down beside me like we'd been friends forever and asked, "Why were you crying when you're the sky?" I didn't even realize I was crying. Not until he said it. That's how it starts. Not with chains or violence or even promises. Just a question that breaks the silence inside your chest. And when you answer, something slips through, something hungry. I told him my name was Lucy, even though that's not what was on my birth certificate. Lucy was the girl I wanted to be, cool, free, a little dangerous. He nodded like it was sacred. "Lucy in the sky," he whispered. "You came to us through the stars." He said us, not me. I didn't know who us was yet. But the way he said it made my skin tingle like static in the air before lightning strikes. He offered me a ride, said he had a place out in the desert, said I could eat, sleep, belong. That word caught me like a hook. Belonging was my poison. I'd been looking for it my whole damn life. The van he drove was old and painted in psychedelic swirls, sunbursts, birds, and naked bodies dancing with snakes. The windows were smeared with handprints. I didn't ask whose. I climbed in and didn't look back. We drove for what felt like hours. The city fell away in layers, streetlights, traffic, smog, all fading into long stretches of dust and Joshua trees. He talked the whole way. Stories about angels and revolutions, about a coming storm where the world would burn and only the family would rise from the ashes. He called it Helter Skelter. At the time, I thought it was just a Beatles song. I nodded along, even though none of it made sense. But the way he spoke, soft, melodic, urgent, it made you want to believe. Like every syllable was the truth you'd been denied your whole life. I didn't realize it then, but his voice was a weapon. And I was already bleeding. When we pulled up to the ranch, it was nearly dark. The sky was still hot, painted with bruised reds and electric pinks. There were girls everywhere, barefoot, sunburnt, eyes wide with devotion. They ran to him like dogs to their master. Hugged him. Kissed his hands. Called him Charlie. So that was his name. Or maybe just the name he gave that day. One girl, tall, blonde, with a crooked smile, looked at me like she already knew everything about me. "We've been waiting for you," she said. Like I was fulfilling some prophecy. Like I mattered. Inside, the place smelled like smoke, sweat, and wild sage. A fire crackled in the middle of the dirt floor. Someone strummed a broken guitar while others hummed and swayed like the music was in their bones. No one asked who I was or where I came from. They just pulled me into their circle. A boy with ink on his face gave me a clay bowl of something warm and sweet. I drank it without asking. That was the first night I stopped dreaming about home, because suddenly I had won. Charlie talked that night. We all sat in a circle around the fire while he told stories about the pigs in power, the lies of the straight world, the purity of chaos. He said love was the only law, and anyone who said otherwise was brainwashed. I watched the flames dance in his eyes. He didn't blink much. And when he looked at you, it was like he was seeing past your skin, straight into the dark parts you didn't even admit to yourself. You were thrown away, he told me in front of everyone. But I don't throw people away. I pick up what the world discards, and I make them shine. They clapped. I cried. I don't know if it was the food, the firelight, or the way he said it, but I believed him. In that moment, I would have done anything for him. Anything to feel like I wasn't trash. We slept in piles that night. Bodies tangled together like roots, sweat and breath and skin. I remember someone stroking my hair as I drifted off, whispering, "You're safe now. Daddy will protect you." But it wasn't protection I was getting. It was possession. I'd find that out later. Much later. Chapter 2. No one leaves the family. There are things you don't question when you're starving, for food, for touch, for someone to say your name like it means something. That's what Charlie gave us. Not food, not really. Not shelter either. At least not the kind that keeps the rain out. But he fed us something deeper. Something that made your bones forget they were ever cold. The next morning, I woke up in a tangle of limbs, half-dressed under a blanket that smelled like smoke and sweat. Someone had drawn a peace sign on my bare thigh with ash from the fire. I didn't ask who. It felt like being baptized into something bigger than myself. The ranch wasn't just a place, it was a living organism. People moved in fluid rhythm. Girls hauled buckets of water and laughed like it was some sacred rite. Boys chopped wood shirtless while singing Beatles lyrics off-key. Everything had this dreamlike haze. We called it the spiral, the energy that connected all of us, like a river you could drown in with a smile on your face. Charlie didn't give orders the way other men did. He whispered suggestions, and people obeyed like they'd had the idea themselves. He said the straight world was crumbling, choking on lies and plastic and police. We were the truth. We were the future. The family. I was told never to use my old name. Lucy was gone. I was Star now. He said I had fire in me, that I was meant to guide the others when darkness came. I blushed. I fucking blushed like a child being crowned. Looking back now, I realize how dangerous praise is when you've never had it. It buries the blade in you before you even see the hand that wields it. Every morning started the same. We sang. Not hymns, but hymns nonetheless. Songs about death and rebirth and revolutions painted in blood. Then we cleaned, cooked, listened. Charlie talked for hours, sometimes strumming a guitar, sometimes just pacing in circles. He told us about the coming war, a final reckoning between white and black America, the rise of the oppressed, the collapse of the system. He said we'd survive it all, watching from the desert like phoenixes in waiting. At first, it sounded like nonsense. But the more he spoke, the more it etched itself into you. You started to see it, in dreams, in songs, in the way the clouds moved across the hills. Reality became flexible. And once that happened, you were his. He gave us acid to open the doors. When you're tripping balls in the Mojave and Charlie starts speaking in riddles, it doesn't feel like drugs. It feels like revelation. He'd sit in the middle of us, eyes glazed, muttering about the Beatles as prophets. Blackbird was about freedom. Revolution 9 was a map. But Helter Skelter? That was the alarm bell. The war cry. The soundtrack to the new world being born in fire and death. I was hooked. Not just on him, but on the feeling of being wanted, needed, chosen. He told me I was one of the pure ones, untainted by society, still capable of full surrender. The pigs out there, he said, they wear suits and hide behind badges. They murder with rules. But you were born clean. I wanted to believe him. I needed to believe him. We weren't allowed to leave the ranch unless he said so. If someone tried, the others would pull them back. I once saw a girl try to walk down the road with a pack and her guitar. Before she made it past the gate, two of the boys tackled her to the dirt. She screamed that she wanted to see her mom. Charlie just laughed, leaned down, and whispered something in her ear. She didn't leave after that. She didn't speak for a week either. That was the first time I saw what he was really capable of. He didn't use violence. Not directly. But his words slithered into your mind and tied knots you couldn't untangle. He'd convince you the cage was home, and the lock was love. At night, we'd all sleep together in the big room. There were no walls, no privacy. Sex wasn't love. It was a ceremony. He said jealousy was poison, a tool of the old world. So we shared everything. Our bodies. Our clothes. Our pain. But he never shared himself. Not really. Charlie always kept something hidden behind those eyes. He could flip in a second. One minute he'd be singing lullabies into your neck, The next he'd be yelling that we weren't listening, that we were failing him. And when he was angry, everyone bled. One night, I caught a fever. Delirious, shaking, hallucinating shadows on the ceiling. I asked for medicine. They gave me a prayer circle instead. Charlie sat by my head and told me the pain was my rebirth. "You're shedding the sickness of the world," he said, brushing sweat from my lips. "Don't run from it. Let it burn." I wanted to scream, but I didn't. I smiled. I thanked him, because that's what love looked like in the family. And still, I wanted to be his favorite. That's what kept us there, you know. Not the threats. Not even the fear. It was him. His presence. The way he could make you feel like you were the only soul on earth that mattered. Until he didn't. Until he turned that gaze on someone else. Then you'd do anything, anything, to get it back. He'd pit us against each other sometimes. Whisper in one ear that the others were doubting, were disloyal. That he trusted you to keep the spiral pure. And then he'd do the same to someone else. It bred paranoia wrapped in loyalty. We smiled while watching each other for cracks. And the thing is, we thought we were free. We weren't prisoners. We could leave whenever we wanted. Except we couldn't. Because when you leave the family, there's nothing left to go back to. You stop knowing where the world begins and Charlie ends. You stop seeing your own reflection. Just a girl in borrowed skin, speaking borrowed words, loving borrowed truths. By the time I realized that, it was already too late. Chapter 3. The Book of Helter Skelter. You can only hear a lie so many times before it becomes your truth. For us, truth was a man with sunburned skin and a stare like a loaded gun. Charlie didn't scream his gospel. He sang it, whispered it, bled it into the cracked wood of the ranch walls until we started repeating it like scripture. Until we heard it in our dreams. And the holiest book we read from? A fucking Beatles record. The White Album. He'd play it at night on a dusty old turntable, the sound warping from the heat, the needle scratching like a heartbeat. The room would fill with that haunted lullaby rhythm, and he'd sit cross-legged in the dirt, shirtless, covered in desert dust and someone else's lipstick. And we'd gather around him like children hungry for a bedtime story. And that's what it was. A bedtime story soaked in prophecy, madness, and blood. "Helter Skelter," he said, voice low, almost gentle, "is the sound of the earth tearing itself apart. It's the race war coming. It's the moment when pigs eat pigs, when Babylon falls, when we take back what was stolen. You hear it, don't you?" We nodded. Of course we nodded. You didn't question him. You let the music wrap around your spine like a snake and pull you into his vision. He said the Beatles weren't just musicians. They were messengers. Paul and John, angels. Ringo, a fool with rhythm. George, a ghost. But they all saw it. They saw the coming war and tried to warn the world. Only we were smart enough, blessed enough, to understand the code. "Revolution 9," he said, "is a blueprint. The chaos. The screams. The fire. That's not art, it's instruction." He made us listen to it on repeat. Sometimes 10, 15 times in a row. That eerie voice, number 9, number 9, number 9, spinning through our skulls like a chant from the void. I remember someone started bleeding from their nose once during one of those sessions. No one blinked. We thought it meant they were getting closer to the truth. He had a way of making your suffering feel holy. You could be hungry, broken, sick, and still think you were the chosen ones. He said we were the seeds of the new world. That when the cities burned and the streets turned red, we would hide in the desert like prophets. And when the dust settled, we'd walk out and claim it all. Every skyscraper. Every dollar. Every soul. And we believed him. Because by then, we'd already stopped being ourselves. We weren't girls and boys anymore. We were the family. He stripped our names, shaved some heads, broke others down with acid and starvation. Then he rebuilt us in his image. I watched Mary shave off her blonde curls while laughing. He said it was blocking my visions, she told me. Hair is ego. Ego is death. She looked like a skeleton when she smiled. But we told her she looked free. He told us that love was slavery. That jealousy was a cage. That to be truly enlightened, we had to destroy the idea of self. That included parents, old friends, memories. One night, he made us bury our childhood photographs in the dirt behind the barn. "Burn your past," he said. "It's the only way to be born again." So I did. I dug a hole with my bare hands, trembling, and dropped the only picture I had left of my sister into it. I hadn't seen her in 2 years. I told myself she wouldn't recognize me anymore anyway. She wouldn't have. He preached about the pigs constantly, rich people, cops, celebrities, all part of the machine. "They smile at you with bloody teeth," he said. "But we'll show them the truth. We'll cut it into them. At the time, we didn't think he meant literal cutting, but that was before he told us about the list. He kept it hidden in his journal, a tattered leather thing filled with scribbles, drawings, codes, and rage. He'd read from it like a pastor on fire. "These names," he said, "are the ones who feed the sickness. These are the ones we will cleanse." There was a name on the list we all recognized, Sharon Tate, a beautiful actress, pregnant, famous. I didn't understand. I asked him quietly, "Why her?" He looked at me, not angry, not cold, just patient, like a teacher explaining something to a slow student. "Because the pigs understand only one language, fear. And when they see their golden girl dead, belly ripped open, they'll listen. The war will start." My stomach dropped. Something flickered in me. Not doubt, not yet. Just a distant echo of who I used to be. But he saw it. He always saw it. He leaned in, his mouth brushing my ear. "You don't need to be afraid, Star. You won't have to get your hands dirty. But you'll help light the fire. That's your gift." And just like that, I felt special again. I wanted to believe I was chosen. That everything I'd done, everything I'd become, it all meant something. That it was part of a holy plan. That night, we painted the walls of the ranch with lyrics. Charlie said it would summon the right energy. He told us to write in blood if we could. Some cut their arms. I used red paint. I still remember the words I wrote. "When the pigs are dead, we will rise." I thought it was poetry. I didn't realize it was a threat. We rehearsed the invasion like a play. Who would be where? Who would carry what? Who would write on the walls? He called it a performance of awakening. And me? I was cast as the watcher. I wouldn't kill. Not with my hands. But I would leave the door open. And when that door swung wide, the family would walk through it, and the world would never be the same again. Chapter 4, Blood on Cielo Drive. There's a sound I'll never forget. It wasn't the screaming, not at first. It was the whisper before the scream. A kind of breathless hush, like the world holding its breath before it drowns. That was the sound when the door opened on Cielo Drive. I wasn't supposed to be there that night. Not inside, just in the car. That was the plan. "You're the watcher, Star," Charlie said. "You keep the spiral steady. You anchor the energy while the others carry the weight." He made it sound like a blessing. A holy role. But it was just a way to keep my hands clean, so I could never say I wasn't part of it. We left the ranch just after midnight, packed into a rusted-out Ford with stolen plates. Tex was driving. He always was when things were about to get bloody. In the back seat, Sadie was humming to herself, braiding her hair like it was any other night. Katie had the blade. Not the knife we used for vegetables. A real blade. Long, curved. The kind you only carry when you plan to make someone bleed. I rode in the passenger seat, staring out the window as Los Angeles passed us by like a sleeping giant, unaware that a nightmare was creeping toward it. No one spoke much. Just murmurs. Helter skelter. The time is now. He will be proud. Like children reciting bedtime prayers to keep the monsters away, never realizing we were the monsters. I didn't know the people inside that house. I didn't want to know. That was Charlie's rule. "Names are illusions," he said. "The pigs are pigs. They have no souls. They are the cancer. We are the cure." And I believed him. I fucking believed him. The gate was open. That detail still haunts me. How something so small, so ordinary made it easy. Tex slipped through first. Then the girls. I stayed behind, crouched low in the bushes near the edge of the property. The watcher. The lookout. The coward. I thought I'd feel power. Righteousness. I thought the stars would shift, and the sky would crack open, and angels would sing because we were changing the world. But the only thing I felt was bile rising in my throat. And then the night exploded. First, a scream. Not loud. Just sharp. Like glass shattering in someone's mouth. Then the barking. Not from a dog, from one of the girls. Sadie, I think. She barked like a rabid animal. That was her way of cleansing the air, she said. To mark the death of the old world. Then came the gunshots. 3, 4. Pause. Another one. And then a baby's cry. No, not a baby. A woman. A pregnant woman. She begged them. I know she did. I couldn't hear the words, but I could feel them. The way her voice broke. The way she screamed like she had more than one life to protect. I pressed my hands to my ears. I told myself I wasn't part of this. That I was outside. That I wasn't the one holding the knife. But I opened the door. I fucking opened the door. And that makes me guilty. It wasn't quick. That's what people don't understand. It wasn't clean or sudden or surgical. It was messy. Screams and blood and panic, and the thud of bodies falling against furniture. I saw Tex come out once, covered in red, and go back in again. Like it wasn't done. Like he'd forgotten something inside. When they finally emerged, it was just before dawn. The sky was bruising at the edges, and the first birds were starting to chirp. They were laughing. Laughing. Sadie had blood under her fingernails and a torn shirt. Katie was carrying a towel soaked in red. Tex wiped his hands on his pants like he'd just changed a tire. "Helter skelter," he said, grinning. "I threw up in the dirt. Charlie wasn't there that night. He never was. He said he didn't have to be. But he made sure we were. He made sure his fingerprints were all over us. Even if none of us touched a doorknob." We drove back in silence. No music. No chatter. Just the hum of the engine and the smell of iron in the air. I kept looking at the blood on Katie's hands. I wanted to ask whose it was. I didn't, because I already knew. Back at the ranch, the celebration had already started. Candles were lit. The fire was burning high. Someone was chanting. Someone else was dancing naked in the dust. Charlie was waiting for us, sitting on his throne made of hay bales and old blankets, smiling like a prophet who'd just seen a vision fulfilled. "You did it," he whispered. "You cracked the sky." He didn't ask for details. He didn't need to. He looked in our eyes and saw it. Saw the kill. Saw the transformation. He walked up to each of us and kissed our foreheads. When he got to me, he paused. His hands cupped my face. "You didn't kill," he said softly. "But you opened the way. That's power, Star. That's purity." I wanted to scream. Instead, I nodded. Because that's what you do when God tells you you're holy. Even when you're not. Even when your hands are stained with invisible blood. I didn't sleep for 3 days after that. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw her. The woman. Sharon. I found out her name later. I saw her belly. I saw the terror in her face. I saw the blood on the walls. They wrote messages. "Pig. Death to pigs. Helter skelter." In her blood. Charlie said it would be a sign. A wake-up call. He said the pigs would panic. That the war would start any day now. But the war never came. The world didn't fall apart. It just kept turning. And we started to unravel. Chapter 5, Trial by Fire, Trial by Love. They took us away in chains. Not all at once. Not in some dramatic standoff. It happened in pieces. Quiet knocks. Midnight raids. A whispered name on a police scanner. One by one, the family was picked off like weeds in a garden the world had finally noticed was overgrown with rot. When they came for me, I was alone in the barn, humming to myself. I'd been drawing spirals in the dirt, over and over, until the skin on my fingers split and bled. I don't know how long I'd been doing it. Days blurred at the ranch after the blood on Cielo Drive. We were waiting for the world to fall. Instead, it found us first. The cuffs were cold. Not metaphorically. I mean physically cold. Steel on bare wrists. Final. They read me my rights. I didn't listen. I was listening to Charlie's voice in my head. They'll come for us, but they can't stop the spiral. The spiral is eternal. But handcuffs feel pretty damn final when they snap around your bones. Jail was quieter than I expected. The first few days I didn't speak. Not to the guards. Not to my cellmate. Not even to myself. I just sat on the cot and tried to hold the spiral together in my mind. I was afraid if I forgot how it turned, counterclockwise, always counterclockwise, I'd lose Charlie forever. But he was still with us. Even from behind bars. We heard about the trial from a guard. "It's gonna be a circus," he muttered one morning, sliding my tray through the slot. "Your guru's got the whole damn media frothing. They put us all together for the arraignment. Me, Sadie, Katie, Susan. We hadn't seen each other in weeks. We screamed when we reunited. Laughed. Hugged like it was summer camp. The guards looked at us like we were rabid. Maybe we were. We carved XS into our foreheads before the trial began. It was Charlie's idea. He said it was to show the world we were X'd out of society. That we didn't belong to their world, their laws, their lies. So we carved them deep. Right into our skin. Blood running down our faces like war paint. And we smiled while we did it. Because he told us to. Because love is what you do without question. Because pain was just another way to stay pure. The courtroom was cold. Not just from the air conditioning, but from the stairs. Reporters. Families of victims. Strangers who came to watch the monsters dance. But we weren't afraid. We sang. Every morning before the judge came in, we sang Charlie's songs. "I'll Never Say Never to Always." "Cease to Exist." Sweet little lullabies written by a madman. We harmonized in our prison blues, voices echoing off the marble. They said we were insane. But I didn't feel insane. I felt devoted. That's worse. Charlie didn't sit with us at the table. they kept him separate. Still, he ruled the room. He carved an X into his forehead, too. Deeper than ours, like he had something to prove. He'd smirk at us from his bench, mouth words we couldn't hear, and we'd mouth them back. During breaks, he'd spin around in his chair like a child, then lock eyes with the jury and grin, like he knew a secret the rest of the world wasn't ready to learn. The DA called us liars. Maniacs. Murderous puppets, he said. And this man, Charles Manson, he pulled the strings. Charlie stood up and laughed. I didn't kill anybody, he said. You did. Society did. Your greed. Your wars. Your lies. You made this happen. I just turned the mirror around. They called that a confession. We called it gospel. The moment that cracked me didn't come from the lawyers. It came from a photograph. One of the prosecutors held it up. It was Sharon Tate. Dead. Naked. Blood-stained. Eyes open. Mouth open. Silent scream frozen forever. I heard someone gasp behind me. I looked around and realized it was me. Charlie looked at me from across the room. His smile wavered. Just for a second, like he saw something slip in me. A crack. A hairline fracture in the bone of belief. And I think, I know. He knew that moment was the beginning of my end. The girls doubled down. More songs. More grins. More declarations of love for Charlie. Sadie said she'd kill again if he asked. Katie recited his teachings like she was reading the goddamn Bible. I stayed quiet. For the first time, I stopped singing. And it was deafening. One night in the cell, I dreamed I was walking through the ranch again. But it was empty. Dead animals littered the dirt. The fire pit was cold. And the walls were painted red. Not in symbols this time, but just the word Y over and over. Charlie was there. Naked. Sobbing. He looked at me and said, I didn't mean to. I woke up screaming. And the spiral was gone. The day the verdict came down, we were shackled together like livestock. The judge read the words, guilty. First-degree murder. Conspiracy. Life without parole. The girls wept. Not from fear. From pride. Charlie closed his eyes like a prophet being crucified. I looked at him and felt nothing. Not hate. Not love. Just the hollow silence of someone who's finally alone in her own mind. Chapter 6. The day the spell broke. You don't wake up all at once. Not from something like this. Not from a spell that was cast with love songs and LSD and whispered promises under moonlight. You wake up slowly. In pieces. Like teeth coming loose in your mouth. Like smoke clearing after a fire, only to reveal bones underneath. For me, it started with silence. The day after the verdict, they moved us into solitary. Said we were too dangerous to be together. No more singing. No more girls stroking my hair at night. No more Sadie whispering that Charlie was the sun and we were his orbit. Just concrete, steel, and my own breath. And silence. It clawed at me. Because in that silence, his voice finally started to fade. And my mind started to come back. I was 20 years old when I learned how to think for myself. Took 3 years. 3 years of gray walls, cold showers, and guards who wouldn't say my name, just inmate or psycho or that Manson chick. 3 years of therapy I didn't trust. 3 years of listening to the girls I once called sisters still preach his gospel through phone calls and visitor glass. 3 years of seeing Charlie's face on TV and feeling nothing. That's when I knew something had broken for good. There was this one therapist, Greer. Heavy-set man with sad eyes. Didn't talk much. Just listened. I hated him at first. He didn't ask the questions I expected. He just kept saying, tell me how it felt. How it felt. How it felt to help murder a pregnant woman. How it felt to throw my soul away. How it felt to let it happen. I wanted to scream at him. Instead, I cried. For 6 months straight. Like my body was purging poison I didn't know was still inside. He gave me a notebook. Said, write it down. Everything. Not the story Charlie told you. Not the version they want for court. Yours. Just yours. I didn't write for weeks. Then one night I started scribbling. It was like carving through scar tissue. I wrote about the first night I met Charlie. The way he looked at me. The way he told me I was light in a world of darkness. I wrote down the exact words he whispered when he pressed his lips to my ear and said, you were meant for more, Star. I wrote how I believed him. I wrote how badly I wanted it to be true. I wrote about Sharon Tate's eyes. I wrote about how I still saw them when I closed mine. Greer read some of it. Nodded. Asked if I felt guilt. I told him no. I told him I felt shame. And then I told him the difference. Guilt is when you know you did something wrong. Shame is when you know you are something wrong. He sat with that. Didn't correct me. Didn't try to soften it. He just said, That's where the healing starts. I didn't believe him. Not at first. But months passed. Then years. And slowly the fog lifted. I started remembering my sister's name. I started remembering my real name. I started writing it again. Clara. My name is Clara. Star was the lie. Star was the veil. Clara was the one who watched from inside while someone else danced for the devil. I had a dream, near the end of my third year in isolation. In it, I was back on the ranch. But the fire was out. The people were gone. The desert was quiet. And Charlie was standing at the edge of the cliff, staring out over nothing. I walked up behind him. I tapped his shoulder. He turned, and his eyes were empty. Not evil. Not powerful. Just empty. Like a puppet after the strings have snapped. I looked down and saw that I was holding a knife. I didn't stab him. I didn't scream. I just laid the knife at his feet and walked away. I woke up crying. But it wasn't fear. It wasn't guilt. It was release. A year later, they took me off suicide watch. Another year after that, I spoke to a reporter. First time I told my story in full. Not Charlie's version. Not the courtroom version. Mine. She asked if I still loved him. I said, I loved what he made me feel. Not who he was. She asked if I forgave myself. I said, no. But I'm learning how to live with myself. That was the truth. And that was the first time I said it out loud. The spell didn't break all at once. It broke in pieces. Like mirrors thrown to the floor. Like a scream echoing through time until it becomes a whisper. Like a name whispered into the dark. Clara. 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 Chapter 7. Her name was Sharon. There's a ritual to the parole board. The way they file in. The scrape of chairs. The weight of silence before someone says your name like they're not sure you deserve to wear it. Clara Monroe. They don't call me Star anymore. I haven't heard that name in years. Not from anyone that matters. The room is small. Windowless. Lit like an interrogation. Three people sit behind a long table, papers spread out like the bones of a dead life. My life. To their left, a state-appointed victim liaison. To their right, a man in a brown suit who won't meet my eyes. He's Sharon's nephew. The only surviving family member who agreed to attend. He doesn't speak. He doesn't have to. His silence is a sentence on its own. It's been 43 years since the murders. I've spent more of my life in prison than I ever did on the outside. I came in a girl. I sit before them now, a woman with gray at her temples, hands that shake, a voice I've spent decades trying to reclaim. And today I'm expected to use it. The chair creaks as I lean forward. There's no script. No lawyer to hide behind. No prepared statement scrawled in ink by someone with a degree and a hope of a headline. It's just me. And the ghosts. So I begin. I'm not here to ask for forgiveness, I say. My voice is dry. Even now, part of me wants to run. But there's nowhere left to go. I'm here to speak the truth. Finally. Out loud. One of the board members glances up. She's in her 60s, glasses low on her nose. She's heard this kind of thing before. She probably expects another apology crafted in therapy, polished in rehearsals, dulled by time. I won't give her that. I give her the wound. I helped murder a woman I never met. I didn't swing the knife, but I helped open the door. I believed a man who said he could see the future. A man who said the world would burn and we'd be its saviors. I pause. No one speaks. Good. They need to sit in it. I was 17. Broken. Lonely. And desperate to belong. But those aren't excuses. They're just context. What I did was monstrous. I glance at the nephew. His jaw is tight. His fingers twitch. I keep going anyway. Sharon Tate was 26 years old. She was pregnant. She begged for her life. For her baby's life. And we didn't listen. I didn't listen. I turned my back. I told myself I wasn't the one with the knife, so I wasn't guilty. I swallow. Hard. She died in fear. And that fear was her last moment. That's what we took from her. Not just her life, but the possibility of peace. I look the board members in the eye. I say her name every night before I sleep. Not as a prayer. As a reminder. Her name was Sharon. The silence thickens. And then the woman with the glasses asks what they always ask. Do you believe you've been rehabilitated? I stare at my hands. Think of the years in the cell. The notebooks filled with guilt. The hours I spent just trying to remember who I was before the family. Before Charlie. Before Helter Skelter etched itself into my DNA. I think about the girls who still call themselves his children. The girls who still sing his songs in their sleep. And I say, no. A beat. Then. But I believe I'm awake now. And I believe that matters. They thank me. Dismiss me. I walk out. The door closes behind me with a heavy metallic thud. I don't cry. I just breathe. That night, I sit on my bunk in the dark and whisper her name again. Not like a mantra. Not like a curse. Just the way you say a name when it matters more than your own. Sharon, if they grant me parole, I'll leave these walls for the first time in over 4 decades. I'll have nowhere to go. No family waiting. No headlines to chase. Just the bones of a life that was almost mine. If they deny me, I'll stay here. Grow older. Quieter. But I'll still speak her name. Because that's what I owe. That's the only thing I can give. There's no ending to this story that brings peace. No ribbon to tie around the horror. But maybe there can be truth. Maybe truth is its own kind of justice. Maybe that's what it means to live with what you've done. To never let yourself forget it. To never stop whispering the name of the woman whose life you helped take.